we have one topic. Top of the list here is a Chapter 55 of the Fire Prevention Ordinance revisions. Mr. Balow, you're going to step us through this?
Yeah. You sound excited. I was asked to do a brief presentation on the changes. Chapter 55 is a brief review. The fire prevention chapter, it authorizes use of the Minnesota State Fire Code, which changes periodically. The Minnesota State Fire Code incorporates the International Fire Code, which is also periodically updated, but not in synchrony, of course. When the one's updated, then we need to update the city's ordinance in order to reflect the current edition of the Minnesota State Fire Code. And that's what is happening in this case. It presents an opportunity to review and revise the fire prevention ordinance. It has to do a style and flow. We can do adds and deletes. The city's ordinance can be more strict than the state fire code, but it can't be less strict. So you can add things to it as a governmental body, but you can't really take too much away from it. The ordinance can't conflict with statute except where the statute says it can. So the bulk of the work is just clerical, that style and flow stuff. It's just kind of modernizing language. The big changes are these, and that's blasting operations. A section on blasting operations was added. It's on your packet, page 6, and it's in the ordinances on page 3. A citizen had expressed a concern to a council member last fall about some blasting that was going on. That prompted a discussion between fire and police on who should be issuing the permits for the thing, and police and fire agreed that fire might as well do it, and we obtained permission from the Commissioner of Public Safety to do that then, because the statute says it's vested with the police or sheriff in the jurisdiction, or if you get the permission of the state fire chief, state fire marshal, then you can extend that to somebody else. So we obtained that permission. The council can choose to restrict blasting operations. That means that you could say, no, we're not going to allow it in the city limits. But I'm afraid that would not leave any practical alternatives to developers. They wouldn't have any way to do some of their excavations. We've had very limited issues with regard to blasting operations ourselves in the fire department. We send assistant fire marshals to complaints to investigate. And then if it's not a code issue, like someone feels that their plaster or their drywall got cracked because of the blasting that's going on, then we put the contractor and the complainant together to work it out. And so far, we've had success with that one. That's a possibility.
Steve, question on the restriction is, can that also be hours of blasting?
Yes. The ordinance and the state fire code currently requires it basically during daylight hours.
But we could restrict that even further.
We could.
One point, jump in here, interject. When we were building Fire Station 2, that was on the docket for the contractor to actually do some blasting because they weren't 100% certain what the soil structure was, but there was a lot of limestone up there. They ended up not having to exercise that option, but I think it is something that probably should be maintained for a developer.
Additional items under the blasting operations section. There's a permit that's required. We issue that downstairs. The person applying for the permit has to provide adequate certification proof that they're competent and capable of utilizing the explosives that they're proposing to use. It requires notice. Each day of any blasting operation, they have to notify our non-emergency number so that dispatch knows what's going on and where. In congested areas, and that has to relate to proximity of occupied buildings, the ordinance and the code requires that the contractor take precautions to limit the earth vibration and any air effects that might occur from the blasting. And then also protective measures such as blast mats are required to be used to prevent projectiles from
Mr. Hickey?
Yeah, I had a question back on certification. So is that something that's specified by the state, what's considered acceptable certification? Or?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right, thank you.
Yep, specific schooling. Let's see, the hours are restricted. Utility has to be notified 24 hours in advance if any of the blasting operations in proximity to any power poles or telephone poles. The data classification is deemed non-public for official use only. So all of the permit application, you know, as far as the hours, what's being used, where it's being stored, that's eyes only sort of stuff. We just can't put that out. That's in the ordinance too then. Any questions on the blasting stuff? 55.07, subdivision 4, certification of plans. This is on packet page 10. This is an add. It's permissive. It gives the fire chief the opportunity to do this if he or she so desires. And what it does is it transfers ministerial duties to a third party. The fire department retains discretionary authority. And the concept behind this is that it potentially provides an opportunity for a cost-effective deployment of personnel, in that if you offload these clerical type things to somebody else, then you don't need to hire somebody yourself to do it. It would allow increased time allocation to site visits by the fire inspector. It would speed up permit issuance. There is an increased cost to contractors because the cost is transferred to them for this part of the permit process. Our folks would still have to go out and physically inspect and make sure that everything is according to code. Then in 55.08, fees. This was part of Aaron's initiative. He suggested that we pull the hard number fees out of our ordinance and locate it all in one ordinance so that it can be handled a little bit more efficiently every time it comes up. So a centralization of the fee schedule seemed like an excellent idea. Allowed routine revision, allows all fees to be reconsidered at once. It reduces the recurrence of fee neglect and decay, which kind of happened to us because our fees haven't been looked at for at least 20 years. And then what that does is it allows for incremental increases over time as opposed to, you know, here we come and we're asking for a 3,000% increase in fees to cover costs. Subdivision 2, these are the increases, and then these were rolled into the proposition to Aaron. It goes from a 2.5% fee on fire protection equipment construction permits. That includes remodels or new construction. Currently, we charge 1.5% of the fire protection equipment supplies, if you will, the pipe, the sprinkler heads, that sort of thing. It's not of the whole construction project. It's only of the fire protection equipment being installed or modified. At 2.5%, we end up about in the middle range of comparable jurisdictions by doing that. The current average fee is $560. That would then increase to an average of $933.
What's the typical cost?
It can range from, let's see, $8 million jumping in my head. That's the total cost of projects. So I don't have a good number for you. I can get that for you.
But the costs are still well beyond what we're charging.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So these are still very heavily subsidized then.
Oh, you mean to us? Our costs?
I mean, our we are paying a portion of the fees.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, we don't fund ourselves with these fees.
Well, and that's what I always like to be fair, and we hear a lot of complaints about fees, but we're usually losing money on them. So yeah. I always ask that same question just to verify, yes, we're still subsidizing it, so it is what it is.
Then there's, we have what's called an operational permit fee. That's if somebody wants to throw up a tent for a business promotion, or an operational permit fee because I have a welding shop, that sort of thing. Any of the state fire code required activities that require operational permits, the proposition would increase those fees from from $55 to $100. And again, that's been a fee that's remained unchanged for as long as I've been here. In the language right now, there's a provision to allow a waiver for charitable organizations, nonprofits, if you wanted that in there. And I'm looking for, one of the reasons that I'm here is sense of the council on if you want that in or you want that out before it gets submitted.
We've had this in other parts, and I'll be the villain and say, please no. Somebody's paying the cost, and if it's not the nonprofits, we're putting it on the taxpayers. And in other places where we've had the option to waive fees for nonprofits, we largely don't do it.
Mr. Hickey?
I guess I'd like to understand the overall cost, like what the difference would be if we did or didn't, what the, based on recent annual fees, what the difference would be.
That's not something that we've tracked, so it would take some research to try and pull out who's a nonprofit charitable organization and who isn't, who have applied for fees in the past.
How many of these a year do you do?
Let's see, of the operational permits, it's just shy of 400.
Okay. Other thoughts on that aspect? You say 400, that's not, is that everything, or what about the charitable? Or?
I don't have that broken down that way, so that would be all of them.
All right. Any thoughts on that? Mr. Hickey?
So, I mean, it sounds like we're talking just a couple $1,000 difference, right, depending on...
That's a potential, and again, I don't have the concrete answer for you, but I can research that.
Yeah, send it to the city administrator, give us an exact number. You could. And run out and weigh in.
Well, this will come forward as an RCA at some point, so between now and that point, maybe you could have a couple of those numbers for us.
Thank you.
We could make a change.
$55.09 allows for routine service reporting. So what we have is a contract with an outfit that receives reports from fire protection equipment contractors who do the code required annual maintenance on fire protection equipment in town. So somebody has a commercial kitchen and it has an ANSEL system, we call it, which is the fire extinguishing system in the hood, or a sprinkler system. They all require periodic maintenance, but we don't participate in that annual maintenance inspection, if you will. So the outside contractor, Bricer, that's who we contract with, processes all the reports that are received from the fire protection equipment contractors who are doing the maintenance. To date, we have not received any revenues secondary to that. This proposition would allow us to charge a $10 fee to cover some of the time. Again, it's not 100% recovery of our personnel that have to handle these reports and then do follow-ups when there are defects in them.
Steve, do you have any idea how much time that takes of staff?
I don't have a breakdown of that for you either. It's perhaps best guesstimate 2 hours a week that's involved in reviewing the report from Compliance Engine. And then you'd have to tack onto that if there were defects that had to be followed up on.
So is $10 reasonable?
Yes, that's why we're suggesting it, is that it's fair.
All right.
Okay, this is the fee schedule, how it would appear in the spreadsheet that Aaron had sent around looking for information. So the fire code specified operation permit, that's the $100 one. The construction modification permit, that's the 2.5% of the system project cost. We currently have a minimum of $100 fee per permit that's issued. Work without a permit that requires a special inspection, that is somebody's engaged in construction and fail to obtain a permit, and it comes to our attention, and we have to go make a special inspection. We charge the contractor who failed to get the permit $250 for that. If we make an inspection and we identify a violation, and we have to come back to do a reinspection, then that's a $100 fee that's charged. The fire protection equipment maintenance administrative fee, that's the one we just talked about, the Bricer, that's the $10 fee. And then the last three are just the actual cost of services, which are fire response expense reimbursement. If we have someone who's deemed responsible for a malicious false alarm, this allows us to recover the actual cost of services for responding to that malicious alarm. The fire department standby charges. Every once in a while we'll get asked either by a fire equipment contractor to bring a fire pumper and personnel to hook up to their equipment to pressurize it to the necessary test pressures, and we charge the contractor the actual costs of doing that. In addition, every once in a while we'll get a request, like the county has asked us to help them out a time or two for wedding receptions that they're building at the fairgrounds, where until they can get a proper sprinkler system installed, we've provided standby personnel, firefighters, with firefighting equipment that's been deemed to be an appropriate alternative to that sprinkler system. And then we charge them for the actual cost of putting those firefighters in there.
Steve, then do you charge if a company is taking their fire suppression system down and wants you on there or needs you there but based on insurances and things?
Yes.
Do you charge for that?
If we're asked to provide firefighting personnel, we would charge for that. Then finally, mobile food units. There's a lot of activity at the state level and the national level with regard to these mobile food units. They've had one or two blow up in the east because of bad practices. But what 55.12, this is a new section. It requires a permit. It would allow an inspection by a fire inspector. And then it covers basic fire safety considerations, such as clearance around the mobile food unit. They can't obstruct exit ways on buildings, for instance. Can't obstruct fire lanes. Requires specific kinds of fire extinguishers based on what kind of cooking material they're using. The council could, if it wanted to, go with a more strict set of requirements on mobile food units, but it's pretty expensive to the proprietor to require the same kind of commercial cooking hoods and fire suppression equipment that are required in a restaurant. The state does not require that at this time. Certainly they might in the future, but they don't require it at this time. And the fact that it's a mobile food unit, and if it's maintaining the proper clearances, the threats to other properties are not quite as big a concern. They'll lose their mobile food unit, but that's the peril of not having robust fire extinguishing systems built into their units. So that's a policy decision for the council. Training, it requires training. Whoever is operating the things has to be oriented on how do you change the LP tank on the thing, when should you do that, how to use the fire extinguishers. If they're using electrical generators, it includes provisions for safe use of those, and how to protect the public against accidentally encountering hot exhaust, that sort of thing. And then electrical, if they're plugging into buildings, it has to comply with the National Electric Code, which is part of the state. This is the fact sheet that is issued along with the permits currently issued by the city clerk's office to provide the safety points. And then the details in there. Just kind of an educational piece for the mobile food unit folks.
One question I had, Steve, as I read through this, I know it's not germane specifically to the fires, but when we show a generator and so forth, do the normal noise ordinance, does that apply in the operation of the generator? I would think it would.
That I am not properly.
Only because we're.
There is verbiage in the mobile food unit ordinance specifically that addresses the generator and
okay. All right. Since I know we've had one or two complaints related to that, but and I, again, it's not germane to the fire. Mr. Campion.
Is the fire requirement that was being added in the new section 5512, that doesn't exist today, and so there's a new set of inspections that need to happen to the vehicles that are going to be done by the city, is that true?
It allows for it.
So I guess if this was passed and adopted, are you asking us to make a determination on whether or not we want to do those inspections, or will the adoption of this begin those such inspections?
The adoption would allow for the permit, and then it would allow for an inspection as deemed necessary. That's kind of permissive language in the code.
Okay. Who would deem necessary, I guess?
The fire marshal.
Okay. So I guess some of the feedback we've been having is just communicating changes that could be coming down the pipeline. So the adoption of this wouldn't apply until the next licensing cycle that would happen in 2019. Is that correct?
Yes, although right now the food truck ordinance doesn't say anything about having a requirement to have a fire inspection to get your food truck license. You know, so to tie these two, there's going to be some work done to tie these things together for that to be, you know, access for licensure.
I assume we'd want to do that administratively, not actually write that into the ordinances.
I mean, the other option is instead of a separate fire permit, we issue one permit for food trucks. You know, and fire does the inspection for it.
Mr. Belka? Steve, on the fire extinguishers, are we requesting that they have K extinguishers in some of these food units, or just an ABC?
If they're using vegetable oils or animal fats, cooking media,
then we do require them.
Right.
That takes a little different training. Is that your responsibility or their responsibility?
It's the food truck owner's responsibility.
Okay. Mr. Ruskin.
I want to go back, Steve, to 5504. I appreciate you putting this in. You know, I was shocked to find that when there's blasting in our neighborhood and some of the areas around, that there's no one seemed to know anything about it. So I understand not getting too restrictive, but one of the things is did you say this went from the police department to the fire department now that you guys will be overseeing this, or was this all under the fire department?
Went from police to us as far as issuance of the
okay,
the
good. And then you'll notify, you say here, you notify the dispatch and so on. Is there ever any kind of thought to any kind of a community notice at all, just so people are aware? I understand that the rub on that and the challenges with it, but I also know that, you know, what I saw was plumes of dust within a couple hundred feet of a existing homes was kind of concerning to me, and you'd think it would be good for maybe like even a posting like we do with some of our other things out there is just inform people a little bit that there'll be blasting on these certain days, because it looks like, I think you said there needs to be another, each day it needs to be noticed, so you kind of know which days it's going to be done. It seems to me it'd be a nice way to at least inform people that when you feel your house rock and you hear something that's because they're building in the, you know, the acres to your south or whatever. So it just seems to me that having some kind of notice, I know that we're saying, you know, that you really can't go around door to door and get everybody's permission, but I think it would be good to have some type of an alert out there. So is there any thought to that? Is there anybody that's doing that, any of the cities that are doing that?
Well, we could use our new threat sister alert system, but the only problem with that is people have to voluntarily sign up for that.
Right.
Unless it's like an emergency, then you get notified anyway. But that would be a thing, you know, I suppose the fire department and or contractor press releases.
Yeah. So it would seem to add some value to that, and it'll allow people at least the opportunity to understand if there's something going on, what days are going to be blasting or whatever, you know. So
well, even if they put up a sign like we're doing with the notifications of committee stuff,
right.
If they would just put a posted boards or somewhere around the area blasting today,
usually what I found is that we heard about the problems after it was kind of done, and people were pretty upset about it. It's like, well, too bad it's done now, and we'll move on. But I just think it would make some sense to have some kind of notification out there that residents and businesses and so on are aware of what's going on in their area within a, you know, 1,000 feet or 500 feet or something. It would seem like some type of a way, but...
I suppose we do make it a condition of permit that they notify at a certain area.
I don't even know how they could do it, but it just... You know, just so that people are aware, it's shocking when you feel it in your house and you hear it and you have your neighbors run around and go, what's going on? And you're like, I don't know, and you don't know who to even ask. You know, I think now this will help us to have some better documentation, and with the dispatch understanding, it seems to make some sense. But
when we do one of the PSAs for road construction or road closure, how broadly is that communicated? Do you need to subscribe to that? Or
yeah, I don't.
I think they should be out there too. They should be out there. Media outlets, police, fire, emergency vehicles, ambulance school gets it as well. School district gets it. It's quite a wide base to send out to. I just point out one thing. You know, Ed raised a good point about notification. Sometimes, as Chief said about projects, it may or may not require blasting. It can take a lot greater planning ahead if we're planning or blasting even remotely considered. So it's not a bad thing. Just be aware of that.
Well, those PSAs might work as a way to say, you know, this is an example in the Fieldstone neighborhood this week, there will be blasting, be aware, being unnoticed, and so on, just to have it out there so that people know. It just seems to me a common courtesy that we should be doing and feel like we understand what's going on instead of nobody knowing what's going on when your house is rocking, you know.
If they had a sandwich board that they could put up in the neighborhood around the area that's blasting, that way people at least see it that it's going to pertain to.
Well, it might be a work in process, too, and I just appreciate you guys being involved with it and you know, understanding our concerns for the neighbors that are out there. So.
The PSA might be the best, easiest way, since we're already familiar with that technique. I know we get it, obviously, so at a minimum, we would be have a heads-up of some activity coming. Mr. Campion.
So the only other thing I would bring up is that this is typically done by developers. They're already kind of familiar with our notification process for development processes. So, again... it would be putting some expectations on the development community to say, if you know 10 days from now that you're going to be doing blasting, there's no really reason that technologically we can't fire off a notice to the neighborhood to say, you're going to send out for 500 feet in any direction postcards and send them over to the planning department who can help them facilitate that sending. I worry a little bit about PSA because... I don't know how that drifts down to people who are maybe not as attached to the government every single day, but you know, if their goal is to kind of get the notice to the neighborhood that's nearby, I think we kind of have those systems out there. It'd be nice to reuse them to get that. But
just a couple of thoughts on that too. Keep in mind that we're always going to have the challenge of it, whether it's sent to the property taxpayer or the current resident, and if the rental of the current resident is not current. So there's cost to sending out postage as well, and you know that should be borne then by the development community, not the taxpayers. The whole conversation's a little bit surreal to me growing up on the Aaron Range, because we had like blasting every day. And we just so I guess that's not every community has that though.
Well, I know it was upsetting us, some of our neighbors, and you know, just the idea, maybe you have a sign that's in that construction zone that says blasting area, so people are aware that there could be blasting going on there. You know, people are alert enough to see it's happening in the summer, they're out walking around, they'll see that. But you know, just letting your kids out and find out that there's blasting is like, if you didn't know that, I'd be a little upset. So I would think that as a parent or a family or a neighbor, you'd want to know if there's something going on within a few hundred feet of your house. So I don't know what the perfect way is to do it. I'm just saying that there was a concern shared with me that there should have been some type of notification when this was going on.
Mr. Nickburn?
With the idea of notification, just be aware that if you say we're going to require notification in advance, you might find developers saying there could be blasting at some point in time in the project, and the notification then becomes almost meaningless. So just be aware of your lead time required and some of that stuff.
But if you put a posting out there and you said if you are going to blast, you need to post it a day in advance or whatever, so people are aware of it. Seems like maybe a realistic way to do it, and also an informative way to do it. And you know, so just again, not saying there's a perfect process that I'm aware of. I'm just thinking that maybe giving it some thought, maybe come up with something that works.
We had debated internally quite a bit about the notice. You know, as far as our brochure is going to be put in the doors of each household abutting the blasting site. But perhaps I could confer with the city attorney and get back to you on possibilities. But that non-public data bit might hang us up with regard to the date and place and time of the applicant's proposed use. So I would have to talk with the experts before I could say, yeah, we could require that as part of the permit that they notify in a broadcast fashion, or maybe the attorneys can tell us, well, I know if they sent a specific mailer to a specific address, that would be okay. But I could get back to you on some options.
So notification, good. And this sounds like something the staff can handle and the council doesn't need to handle. I wanted to go a big picture on some of this stuff. In general, have we taken all of the the repetitive stuff, have we taken that out of, we're not copying the state language or referencing the section of the state statutes now?
No.
Do we rewrite the information that's in the state statute, or do we just reference the state statute?
In most cases, we reference the state statute.
Which is the best way to do it, because it's impossible to keep it current otherwise.
Right.
And then I just want to make sure, too, my assumption is that the ordinance creates the fees, but then the fees are set by resolution by the council?
Right.
Okay.
Mr. Ruska.
Perhaps just as a follow-up, maybe you can look at, maybe if there's other cities that do some type of notification or posting that are maybe is already out there, you can steal some ideas. But
good idea.
I remember maybe over the years seeing signs that say blasting, or you just knew that that's what, that seems like an easy way to do it. At least it gives some information and makes people aware. It just, you know, it wouldn't take any kind of special notifications, it wouldn't take any kind of process, it wouldn't limit people, but it would give a way to do it. So just a simple thought that maybe that might work, but maybe coming back with some ideas. Maybe no other cities are doing it, and I just find it hard to believe that there's plastic going around neighborhoods and nobody thinks enough to inform people that maybe that's happening.
Mr. Campion.
Before adoption, I'd like to get a proposal from staff on how we unify this document in the mobile food unit ordinance so that we don't have kind of duplicate permitting process for those.
Yeah. Very nice.
All right. Anything else then on this topic?
Appreciate you doing it.
Yeah.
Yep. Thanks, Steve.
All right. Thank you. All right.
One chapter down.
Before we move on to our, we only have two closed session items left, but before we do that, we'll take up any other business that the council might wish to, and I know Mr. Wojcik has one item.
Yeah. All right, what I wanted to do is ask our city clerk about what it would take to create a downtown polling location for early and absentee voting. Most places do this. The county has one, but it's not accessible to most transit routes, so it requires a stopover, and not all of our polling places are in the best locations. So I know a lot of other cities, Minneapolis included, does this. So what do we need to know?
Right, so there's two different options that we have for polling or for absentee voting locations. What's within the control of the city is the city clerk's office can be designated as an absentee voting location. The county can designate us as an absentee voting location, or we can notify the county that we are designating ourselves as an absentee voting location. The county and I, early this year, had some preliminary conversations around the potential for different improvements around elections and working together, and they've been good partners in trying to discuss some of these things. We had talked about trying to do something for the general election, potentially. I did have some very preliminary conversations with them about what does it look like if we try to do something for the primary. They're a little reluctant because of the time frame so that we can coordinate things with the ballots and everything. So if that's something that the council is interested in, you know, I think there's a lot of value in it. For those of you who don't know, my background is in voter outreach and education work. Coming here from Minneapolis, that was the core of my work for the last several years there. And we are in a situation where, as a city, you know, the four races that we have on the ballot are city races this year. Three of them are going to a primary this year. That's unprecedented for us. We have two school board races going to a primary this year. And we have several state races going to a primary. And unlike in many years, a lot of those state races are really competitive. You know, in 2016 in the primary, the only statewide race on the ballot was the Supreme not a big turnout driver. This year, I think it's going to be a little bit different. And the part that the city does run in the election process is staffing polling places and coordinating polling places. We haven't added polling places in quite a long time. And, you know, I'm looking at right now, the way we typically staff for a primary, we staff with half of what we staff on a general election. That's not going to cut it for this year. And that's a huge recruitment challenge for us to make sure that we're adequately staffed for the primary. The relief valve for that is if you get more people to vote early, absentee. And that's something that we really pushed in Minneapolis, and we saw quite a big push around. So 2014 was the first year that anybody could vote early absentee with no reason. So turnout was 91%. We increased, I saw your request, Michael. We increased 91% from 2010 to 2014. So like election cycles, because you want to compare like election cycles in absentee voting after that law change in Minneapolis. I don't know the numbers here because it's not broken out quite the same way in the stats I can look at. And we've also seen in Minneapolis a much bigger shift where now the majority of the voters that vote before Election Day in Minneapolis do so in person instead of by mail. So it's something that's been very well received when it was made more available. The majority of the time, absentee voting is a 46-day period before each election. The majority of that time, it's a trickle. The first day is an onslaught, and the last week is an onslaught. Mm-hmm. In between, my staff can handle it at the front desk, in between the parking tickets and licenses and all the other fun stuff we get to do. The rest of that time, we would need to bring in election judges or seasonal staff, some additional assistance for those. You know, that first day period and that last week, it would be my estimate. So there'd be a financial impact. I don't think it would be a huge financial impact, but it would also help alleviate what we experience in the polls on election day. Because the last thing you ever want to have is everything going haywire on election day.
And you had the staff.
So logistically, what are the requirements? Do you set up some of those plastic voting booths so that people can fill out a ballot?
Right.
And do they have to be in some, obviously, a monitored area with staff so that they can hand out the ballots?
Right.
Any particular requirements as far as where they can be located? Or
we could facilitate that in our rotunda.
Okay.
And I feel like that's an ideal place so that we can, you know, maintain our counter traffic and keep the staff. My staff is pretty tightly tied to that.
Right. I just didn't know if there were some requirements, given that there's normal business also occurring in that area. Does there have to be some physical separation?
Making the voting booths available would help facilitate that. And so, again, that would be something where, you know, we want the partnership of the county on that. We don't want to just tell them we're going to do this. We want to go into this with a partner with the county because they have that equipment.
Mr. Campion?
I'm perfectly supportive of encouraging our staff to reach out to the county and see if there's a way to execute that for this election season and coming back with us with a proposal on what we can do and let's take a look at it. Because I think the reality is, you know, everyone wants to have better access to the elections, and we understand how important that is for the citizens of our community to be able to go out and vote. So, you know, I don't see any problem. I think the statement you made that's most important to me is I think we want to work together with the election system that the county is putting in place to make sure it's not like we're doing this in spite of you. It's how do we work collaboratively to get something done that's going to be a benefit to the community.
All right. So you'll come back with a more defined idea of what we have to do.
Yeah.
We'll jump to the administrator and set up a meeting for the four.
And let us know then too if it's I mean, we've got, you know, based on the 46-day window, we could potentially do it for the primary, work out any kinks for the general too. So if that works out, just let us know.
Okay. All right. Any other business then for the council before we close the meeting? Hearing no one, I will turn it over to Mr. Gosley to do what you need to do to close the meeting.
All right. We're going to have two separate sessions that are going to be closed. So I'm going to read the first one, and then when we complete that first item,